Episode 71. Hello, Bootstrap.
Will you stop yelling? It's making it shaky sounding.
Oh, Lord. You're too sensitive, Lensman.
You got, where's the professional operation?
It's not here.
All right, we have a guest this week.
We do. Natalie Portman. No, Jane Portman.
All right.
That would be quite a, you know, Natalie Portman. That would be big. We have to change the whole focus of our podcast then, but.
You know, she has a new movie out. It's called Jane's Got a Gun.
Really?
Oh, no. World's
or something away. Like that. Yeah, so I'm thrilled. Haven't seen it.
You're a fan?
I have to be.
You get that a lot.
Jane Portman from UIBreakfast.com.
Yeah, so we met a while back in at MicroConf, although I think we might have like interacted on the internet a little before that, I don't recall. But yeah,
it was great, and it was 3 years ago. Yeah. Now Ian has a beard and everything has changed so much, you know.
Oh, bearded. I've always been slightly bearded, but now it's like an official, like real looking beard. So yeah, I don't know. Like, did you go to MicroConf this last year, this last one?
No, I keep buying tickets and then swapping them back because trips to Vegas are just so far away. So I end up going to Europe instead.
So that's crazy. You're in Russia. So you come in to all these conferences over here from Russia every time, right?
I do. I just came back from Chicago and I'm going to Philly pretty soon. Hopefully we'll meet up at Bacon Biz.
Yeah, we're all going to Bacon Biz in a couple of weeks.
Oh, you're going to Bacon Biz too. Good. Everybody's going to be at Bacon Biz.
Actually, it's funny. The way I got my ticket is I swapped mine for MicroConf's ticket for Amy Hoy last year. And then Bacon Biz didn't happen. And now I have like an eternal pass for Bacon Biz, which I'm using.
I was just talking to my wife yesterday. I'm like, when I have to go to Philly, it's like 10 miles away. And I'm like, oh, I have to take the train to the city and I have to pack. And I have to, and Jane is like, I'm just going to do a quick run to Philly and I'll be back to Russia in the weekend. So it's like nothing for some people. And for me, it's like a whole...
We're trying to get you to just leave the house.
That's right.
Step phase one. Yeah, well, you know, they got the flights from Russia now. It's not like a, it's not a hard thing. She doesn't have to like sneak over the border or anything. It's, you know, it's like a thing.
I have a visa. I'm legal. Stuff.
Everything is hard and everything is scary. I still think that if I go back for a visit, they'll never let me back in the country. So.
They don't want you there that bad.
That's true. They don't want me here that bad either.
All right. So, yeah, I know there's like you're doing so much here. I don't even know where to begin. Maybe you could give everybody a little bit of background just for those who don't know you and what you've been up to, and we can kind of go from there.
All right. So the last few years, I've been an independent consultant. Before that, I was a creative director at a large agency. And then I had two kids sequentially and decided that I want to go and explore the international market. And then the last few years, I've been writing books, building authority, going to conferences and doing other fun stuff, which ended up in a lot of great consulting work. And these days, I just launched a book called The UI Audit, which helps software founders, SaaS founders make wonderful, focused, beautiful products.
I would think this applies to not just SaaS.
I was just about to ask, is this SaaS specific? Like, is there stuff that needs to be a SaaS thing?
It's very much focused on web applications. Mm. So it might be not a subscription model, but it's about web app internals, I would say.
Okay, so the stuff that happens after you log in.
Right, right. Okay. And I find it way more interesting than like conversion rate optimization because, you know, we've optimized the hell out of our sites, but we haven't optimized the hell out of our web internals yet, I think.
Me and Andre hate the optimizations, right, Andre?
I don't even like web development. I don't know why.
Well, this will be good for me because like HubSpot, right? Now there's a SaaS version of HubSpot, but it's still majority not. It's still you can download it and run it on your own servers, but it is a web application. So, you know, all these things still apply, which is great. Right. And yeah, that's an area I do feel like people get so focused on the optimization of your funnel and all that stuff, which is all, you know, important, somewhat. But, then the app itself sometimes gets a little bit forgotten. And that's, you know, that's why people buy.
Absolutely. Because I do understand that, you know, sales and marketing is how the business runs. but there is like a separate world of designers who have no clue like how businesses are organized at all. And then there is a whole world of startups who are only care about billing, SaaS and billing, sales and stuff. And this, I'm trying to bring these two worlds together with this book somehow. And people seem to like it.
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask if you feel like it's more for designers or is it for founders, or I assume it's kind of applicable to both, but is there one kind of market that you're really focused on?
I've written everything specifically for founders. I'm saying like, dear founder, this and that, but you know, designers can benefit a lot from what I say to founders. But it makes it so much easier to write everything, to make the copy really crispy and to just, you know, really advocate for the founder's interests.
Now, is the approach for that you take for like after you log in, is it more like you approach it as a designer that you take your experience and you advise as to what changes should take place? Or is it more like A/B testing with statistics and measurements and all of that sort of stuff?
I'm really bad at the second part. So it's about thinking from the top to the bottom, from, you know, defining the product strategy and tying up key user tasks with what you see on the screens. So the screens are maximum simple and transparent and easy to build and to use kind of thing. And I really, really would love to be an expert in quantitative data, but I'm not, because usually small businesses don't have funds and resources for that.
And that, I mean, that's just so much stuff out there on that too. And I feel like that's where everybody went there for a few years. So like, and obviously your approach is much more in my sort of style, I guess you'd call it that. You know, I'd rather think through the problem and, you know, I don't want to, I'm not, it's just not interesting to me to like, let's make 400 versions of this button and, you know, and see how that works. And also in a bootstrapped product, like you're not going to have enough visitors to, you know, because now, especially for inside the app, like this isn't even just your website where, okay, maybe you're driving traffic there or have ads or whatever. I mean, you know, how many people are you going to have actually in your app? Are you really going to have enough to have, you know, a million buttons to test and all that kind of stuff? And at some point you get to a size where that might make sense. But yeah, like early on or just, you know, if you're small, it's like, that's a lot of development time and work and effort to measure something which you don't even know if it's statistically relevant and all that kind of stuff, where I like the idea of thinking through the problems. And also it makes you think about the product. It's not just about if this button should be this way or that way, but it's like you'll have other insights when you go through that process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love the way you say that.
There you go. Put me on there.
So what's the process like if somebody wants to... okay, so first of all, why would somebody want to, like, how would somebody recognize that they would want to revamp their what is that part of the web app called? It's not the back end, right? It's like the app itself, the app proper.
Like the UX, the user interface, right, the UI.
How would somebody know that they would, like, need to consider revamping that part of their application?
You know, it's not exactly... the word revamping is probably not the right word, because people don't usually like global redesigns, and it's more about small tweaks. But you know, most often I see software that's built by founders themselves, by developers, and developers are perfectly logical people. And if there's something wrong, they can kind of sense that, you know, something's not making perfect sense here. I can feel it, but have no clue how to improve it. And that's when they might want to seek professional help or like some kind of do-it-yourself guidance. And that's what I'm trying to help with.
So now, do you have, like, would you eventually like to have a software business, or are you pretty comfortable in the kind of consulting and content, you know, marketing and all this stuff?
I would love to, but, and I have, like, I've had a few aspirations, and I'm a very aspiring founder, but I'm not technical, and I'm also not a big fan of, like, sharing and making decisions split on 50% with someone else. So right. I'm such a total control freak that I probably would not, you know, live well together with a technical founder. So it just ends up that as a big technical burden for me, or a huge investment and a technical burden, or something like that. And I do realistically know that and maybe another couple years, I probably won't take up such a huge thing. But I would love to. It's my long-term goal.
Yeah, because I was like, I mean, we've talked about this on the show before, but what you're doing is kind of like the kind of playbook for this stuff nowadays, right? Is like, you know, you kind of have a blog and then you have a podcast, then you have a course and then you have an ebook. So like you go through that escalation of, kind of different smaller products on your way to maybe doing the bigger one and building up your audience along the way, which is not mine and Andre's style, but it is interesting to see somebody kind of in the middle of that and seeing how it's going. I guess so far it seems like it's going well for you and you've kind of built up an audience and
yeah, I have, as of today, have a list of around 6,000 people, which I'm terribly proud of.
Yeah,
because that's great. Because I mean, it's been built from scratch, and I know every 50 people who've been obtained to get on there, was really slow. But I, you know, it's supposed to be like a good funnel and a good line, but I find that it's not as smooth in real life as I'd love it to be.
Right.
So people who buy free courses don't necessarily buy books, and people who buy books don't necessarily read them. Right. And those people who buy my services don't necessarily read any email subscriptions at all. But there is minor like overlap that I allow to happen, and I still keep trying. And overall, the impression is great. But I find it's much more interesting and challenging in real life.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Whenever you read those posts that are like, oh, look at, you build these three things and the one leads into the other and then magically I made $1 million. Like that in reality, it's never quite that simple.
But if you don't do these three things, nothing's going to happen for sure. So you got to keep trying kind of. I mean, it is obvious path, but it's not so direct and it's definitely not fast.
I wonder if it's like a times have changed sort of thing. Cause I remember when we were doing the BlackBerry stuff, 6-7 years ago, whatever, we had this huge mailing list, but we didn't build it up through courses or anything like that. It was just sort of like, tell us how you found us and we'll give you 10% off on your purchase type of a thing, you know, like little things like that on the website. We got a huge mailing list over the years off of that. And all I used it for, I never sent any courses or anything like that. All I ever used it for is just to send out an email saying, oh, there's a new version of this or a new version of that. And that converted like crazy. It was like 100 times the sales of, you know, the previous month or something, or over the course of a day, and 100 times the support, whatever. But it worked. Like that was like the biggest thing that we did that brought in money, was to release a new version and to hit that mailing list. But now I see everybody's doing, you know, the sort of like mailing list generation thing with courses and books and tools and things like that. And I don't see people like really saying that, you know, like Jane is saying, it's not as smooth as like people claim it is.
Right.
So I'm not sure whether it's like a times have changed type of a thing or what, but like I remember we having a lot of success with that.
Yeah, I mean, that's some of the stuff we're doing with HelpSpot is like building up content and stuff like that. And then we have a course coming out and trying all these things. And it's like, I do think it is somewhat time to change just because there's so much more competition. And yeah, like in the old days, we just had our list and whatever. And it was like more, I feel like you didn't reach as many. There's this aspect of like normal people too, right? Like when we started, it was like other geeky people followed us and they didn't care about anything other than tell them when the new version's out. Mm-hmm. And now it's like you're dealing with a lot more just like people who aren't technical, who don't know about the stuff, and then just kind of ease them into it. And so there's a lot more stuff like that. But I don't know. I do wish, it's funny because I was just thinking about this the other day how, you know, HelpSpot had like 80 people on the list when we started, and that was the whole mailing list. And then as soon as it got busy because we started selling some, that's it. I never did anything with the list again. I never blogged again, basically. And it's like, boy, if we had been building up our list over the past 12 years, that'd probably be a pretty big list. So that part's a little bit unfortunate that we didn't like take advantage of that while we had the chance. But yeah. I mean, we have trials and everything, but not a more explicit list.
But Jane, do you feel like you got a lot of the consulting business that's taking off? Do you think it's more as a result of, you know, this list and the things you're building for people who are on this list? Or is it more like the conferences and the speaking engagements and all of that?
I think there is no direct link like I can make between incoming leads and actual activities. And really, I can say that my list is bringing in my leads. Like, I've tried selling expensive audits to the list, and really, some success happens, but very rarely. So it's not that I have the leads from the list, but like building a list and going to conferences and doing that, it creates some kind of, you know, authority aura, karma or something, which just brings in people into your universe, and then you figure out what to do. Like, some of them want consulting, some of them would want your book, etc. And well, you know, guys, you've been really lucky that you can make money and make, you know, sales without having to do the heavy email marketing. That rather, that's a benefit, actually. That's a good story, because it would be bad that if email were the only source of your leads, and it wouldn't work. That would be really bad.
I don't know how much of it is like skill, as much as we wouldn't even know how to do email marketing or anything.
We're learning. I'm trying to learn anyway. But yeah, it's tricky. I think also we've just been around a long time, which helps. Like, when you start at the beginning of something, then you have advantages because you're just around, and like you get known for no necessarily not as like any real reason, but other than you've been around. But so
is that the only reason why you get trials? Just word of mouth?
Well, I mean, I don't know about that in terms of us personally. Like, for HelpSpot, I mean, it's definitely a lot of like people who use the product at a previous job, or like they leave and they become the help desk manager at a new job and they bring us with them, things like that. But yeah, we are, I mean, that's one of the things we want to do, is like that aura, like you talked about. It's like the people on your list, I think, are not, that's our approach to this. What I've been playing with anyway is like less focused on, you know, kind of like the C-level people, although that's, I mean, it's great to have them, but they're also kind of harder to reach and they're really busy. So like, get more of the frontline folks and then let them be sharing your stuff and everything, and try to create that kind of aura of activity, and then people kind of fall into it. So where the list might not be directly, yeah, you don't send to the list and get a bunch of sales directly. It's more of a thing where those people are then sharing your stuff or talking about it to colleagues or whatever, and it filters up that direction versus being so explicit on your truly, you know, decision maker market. But at least in the kind of B2B world, I think that's kind of a viable thing, or at least what I'm testing now anyway.
We'll see. Yeah, absolutely.
I think I'm the worst person to ask as far as how our sales are going. I don't do any marketing. Really, I don't do any advertising. Oh, like, I try to do advertising after every product release and never works out. I don't do any, what else do you people do? I don't do any content, like writing type of stuff. We don't do anything. It's just like, we just release stuff and stuff comes in. So I guess it's all word of mouth. The bad part about it is, first, it's slow. And second, it's not, like, you can't do any testing against that. It's not traceable at all.
Well, that's one of the things that you'd be good at, Andre, is like the more like kind of like engineering is marketing. Like, we did that thing with HelpSpot Vault, which got some traction. I mean, it's not huge or anything, but we definitely had people signing up for the newsletter and people linking to us and everything from it, you know, because that's like what we like to do, is build things, you know. Like, the content stuff is not as fun as, you know, building software. So we can kind of combine the two. So that's why I'd like to do some more stuff on that front too, of like, you know, engineering is marketing sort of initiatives.
No, I was just saying, the fault there is that you wind up releasing a lot of stuff that just doesn't fly.
Right.
And yeah, so that's the hit you take. The hit you take is putting in hours into stuff that will never work out, as opposed to having one thing and trying to push against that in marketing.
But the same is true even with the content marketing, right? It's like, you could write a bunch of stuff and nobody cares. And then you're like, oh, I wasted all the time on writing this stuff or whatever. So I think it's like, it is just finding time to do marketing in general ends up being the issue, right? It's like between developing the stuff you're developing, or if you're consulting, doing the consulting, and then, you know, just everything else that you have to do running a business. And then it's like, well, when do I have time to write something, whether it's a new program or just blog posts or whatever? It's hard to make the time.
Exactly. And, you know, it resembles like a war with yourself on a daily basis, because I've primarily been doing marketing the last few weeks, and it's like, I'm fighting with myself. I don't have any client to have like direct input from, because I've been like getting up my consulting practice after the book launch lately. So I had a break, and, you know, I'm talking to 1,000 people at once, and people, you know, keep emailing me and stuff. And it's like 1,000 small clients or people who give feedback. There is no one single person who would, you know, pay you $10,000 and say, Jane, you're doing great, which is a huge validator. It's much more intricate and interesting. It's such a roller coaster of feelings when sometimes, you know, you get great feedback in the email in the morning, or you don't have a great feedback. It's just silence. It's interesting. It's very interesting.
Plus, you don't know what the context is, what the situation is for each of these other people that are sort of like giving you feedback without engaging with you on like a big project that they have skin in the game with. So it's just, I think it's a different sort of feedback altogether, just having people come off of a piece of content that you wrote for them or a book or something like that, as opposed to like a client that you spend months with and you know exactly what you're doing for them and they know exactly the value that they're getting from you.
So Jane, give us the, what's kind of the top little tip you have for launching your book? Like what's one thing you did that worked really well and got people interested in it, either buying it or at least getting kind of on your list and things? Was there something you did that really worked well, or was there any one thing that really stood out?
I think a few things I did really right. First, I gave a talk at MicroConf Europe, which was which had the same name as a free course, and the course had the same name as the book. So the book is called The UI Audit. The course was called The 1 Hour UI Audit. And I had a talk named 1 Hour UI Audit. And it all kind of tied together. And then I launched pre-orders and it kind of worked quite well. Mm. So it's a combination of, conference promotion you can do, then pre-orders, and then a product hunt launch with the course. But to make people come to you, I think a product hunt launch of a free course is the best tactics I can find. Because otherwise, how would you make like 500 people come to you just for nothing, you know?
Right.
Out of nowhere, fresh qualified leads.
Yeah, that's right, your own product hunt. And how'd that work for you? So I guess that was pretty good. Product hunt's interesting. Like, I don't really know what to make of it. We were on it with the HelpSwap Vault, and it was like fun, but it did send a lot of people. So I guess that's good. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah. You know, with the book launch itself on Product Hunt, I didn't get as much traction as I was hoping for. Mm. But I guess free courses make especially good job there.
Right.
And my course was called it was specifically called UI Audit for Founders. And I figured that if I would have called it like someone more flexible, I would probably get more people on the list, like more general design public. So I would get maybe 1,000 people instead of 500. I don't know. It's tough. It's, again, a problem of positioning, like whether I should really say SaaS founders or whether I should say not.
Right. Well, and getting to talk at something like MicroConf is great, because obviously everybody there is a potential customer. So that's perfect alignment there. And also all those people have blogs and Twitter accounts. And you know, those are kind of people who are going to be talking about it, which is perfect. And I think people don't realize how it's not as hard. It's like scary, but it's totally doable to get a speaking slot at one of these conferences. Like, you know, conferences need people to speak at them. And if you start to just build up even a small kind of reputation, it doesn't have to be like you're world famous or you have 5 books or whatever. I mean, it doesn't take a lot to get on to become a speaker at a conference, especially at the smaller ones. And
yeah, I did it. And I have no idea what the hell I'm talking about.
Exactly. That's not true. You know what you're talking about, but yeah, I think that's an interesting thing. And then especially if you have really great alignment like that, versus like kind of just any old conference, but still, and once you get talk at one, it's much easier to talk at others because people can see that video or you can, you know, reference that. So I don't know. I've stopped talking at conferences for a while just because it stresses me out.
It's a lot of work. It's a lot of prep work.
It's a lot of work. Yeah. It's a lot of work and it's stressful. Although I am giving some like 10-minute talk at Bacon Biz, but that's going to be quick. So that's only like 60 people. So, and I know like all of them, so it's not really stressful, but still.
I'll be talking to you about navigation and web apps.
I'm still figuring out what I'm talking about, but I think I know. It's some kind of B2B sales process kind of talk, I think.
Wait, is everybody supposed to be doing a talk? Or
no, not everybody talks. Good. It's not everybody.
60 people.
Yeah, I think it is ends up, I mean, it is mostly just small talks. It's not big talks. So I think it will be like probably whatever, 15 people or whatever it is. But no, it's not everybody.
Yeah, so with conferences, I think the biggest discovery for most people is that you kind of land yourself at a conference instead of getting invited, like half times, especially the first ones. Like, and the same is valid for podcasts, as you might guess.
Right, as you see here.
Right. And in many other cases, so nobody will, you know, sit down at night and think like, there's Jane, I'm going to invite her. Well, too bad. It doesn't work like that. You got to do some legwork.
But even then, you know, it's sort of like the approach is like you just sent a normal email and it's fine. But we've had, at least I've had pitches for guests on this podcast that are like, they're just late night infomercials. They're like, we have this client who's been on like Oprah and has helped these people. And here's a video to him. And here's a bunch of books he wrote. And it's like the whole thing is just like screaming pitch. Right. And like, I don't want this person on the podcast.
Well, I think it also too, it's like, especially in our bootstrapper world, right? It's that if you can just get out there a little bit, even if it's just talking to people on Twitter or whatever, and obviously meeting them in person at conferences is even better. But like, if you can just get a little bit on people's radars, then when you send that email, you know, it's like, you're asking your friend, even though or you're asking an acquaintance at least, right, for something. And that's a much easier and different conversation than, yeah, just like straight cold emailing or, you know, these bigger people who will contact us sometimes, yes, who are like have a PR firm that's just contacting us on their behalf or whatever. And it's kind of sleazy feeling. And, you know, it's been a million of these emails sent out, even though, you know, that shouldn't matter. It's kind of like it does. If you know, it just makes that difference, right? Like if you have that opening, if you know the person and you can say, hey, Ian, like I have this new cool thing. What do you think about being a guest? Like that's a much stronger proposition than, you know, hey, person I've never, you know, talked to. You want me on your show because I'm super famous and blah, 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 which is kind of, I mean, especially to me and Andre, is especially off-putting, but in general, I think it is.
But you know, those, you know, actual friends connection, actual human, you know, interactions is the most precious thing I've earned over the last 3 or 4 years. I've been actively doing stuff like it cannot be converted into money, but it's so precious. It's like if I had to start over, I could start over with people. I would just give away the list and start with zero. It would be much easier if I know like the same 200 people I know today and I didn't know 2 years ago.
Right. Yeah, no, that's where like, especially now that everybody works remote and it's all virtual, it's like that is where going to conferences and things is useful to just make those human connections and have an hour conversation with somebody that they then remember, you know, for years and passing tweets or something on a forum or things like that, which is all good too, but it's all these different levels of kind of connection.
Exactly.
All right. So let's talk about our super deluxe, awesome friends at Linode. Linode, gosh, it's like, I love the Linode. So I'm launching some new stuff. We launched a new HelpSpot website and I have this other kind of sub things going on right now. And it's like, I'm just adding them onto this single Linode instance. And it's only the 1 gigabyte instance, tiny, but it handles everything. I mean, we don't have any trouble. We were on Product Hunt. We get linked from different places, never an issue. So yeah, I mean, still huge Linode fans. For people who are listening who don't know, you know, 8 data centers, servers starting at $10 a month. It's all SSD. It's all modern Intel CPUs. It's all, you know, the backups available for like pennies. It's all you know, high speed networking, 40 gigabyte a second networking, money back guarantee. So 7-day money back guarantee. If you try it and you don't like it, they'll give you your money back, which is great. And of course, if you sign up with the Bootstrapped offer code, which you can get at linode.com/bootstrapped.fm, then you'll get $20 free. So basically 2 months of a 1 gig server to try it out. And kick the tires with it, throw up a side project you have on there, or move your website over to it, anything like that. Just get started with it. really simply and cheaply with the $20 off and see how you like it. Again, I've been a customer for many, many years, and I know Andre uses it as well. Yep. So definitely check out Linode. Thanks to them for sponsoring. If you need a server, which basically everybody listening to this podcast does, definitely check out Linode. And that's linode.com/bootstrappedfm. And we'll have the link in the show notes as well. Thanks again, Linode.
This is the part where I say that next time I will read the ad if I get the ad copy from you. And I learned all those acronyms about the servers that I have no idea what you're talking about.
Stop it.
I have a question. So I don't do web dev. I mean, I do enough web dev to throw a website up. But a lot of the times I still have to have like a backend for customers to log in and update their stuff and do some management type of a thing. So it's sort of a web app, but it's not like a SaaS web app. But still, you know, it sort of needs a user interface and experience and all that. So my approach usually for the first sort of version, I mean, later on if the product is successful, my wife usually does like a full redesign and proper thoughtful type of a thing. But first round is I go on like Theme Forest or something and I download like an $11 backend admin template or something that has 1,000 JavaScript filled pages and it's like 110 megabytes on load. And I just, you know, throw up that up on a server or something, and you know, it has a bunch of tables and it has a menu on the left hand side and whatever, and that's what it is. And I'm guessing a lot of people who write software who are not web developers sort of take that route or a similar route. So is there like a common mistake that winds up happening in these situations from like a user experience perspective?
Oh, that's a good turn. I thought you were going to say like, is that all right?
No, I know it's right, because I'm not going to say what I've been doing for 10 years is wrong.
Exactly. So I always advocate for themes and templates. I have the whole like chapter in the book saying like themes are great. There's like a designer who's been designing it for 200 hours and testing it, and it's way better than anything you're going to make yourself. So what I don't like about many themes is you know, there are a few common flaws that happen in the themes themselves that people just grab and copy into their own designs. Mm-hmm. And that's usually a huge redundance of icons in the navigation. So it's like 20 navigation items and each has like an icon that doesn't say anything specific, which makes the whole thing very colorful, bells and whistles, but doesn't make much sense. And also, a lot of them are pretty dark, and sometimes you want them light. You know, if you just open up like Theme Forest or whatever, you're going to see like a bunch of left side panels, which are black. Right, and right. Sometimes you don't want to do that. You want to go for white. And you just won't find a white theme for some reason, because I've tried that a few times. Mm. And another flaw is the left side navigation. It's not a flaw, but you know, there are two navigations you can go for. A top version, like a panel, and the left side panel. And sometimes it's better to have a full width data table and a top menu, but for some reason, maybe like 10% of the themes have a top menu.
Right.
And I think that's a big problem, because such apps are easier to manage. They're easier to make them responsive and just to understand, generally speaking. I think these three common flaws get repeated themselves into the actual live projects. Most often.
I think what happens is, you know, Theme Forest is a marketplace. And like any marketplace, you're going to have one that's a runaway success and then 100 people that are trying to copy that person. And you wind up having the top 20 themes that are structurally identical and not necessarily paying attention to what's better for the user, but paying attention to what's going to convert that theme for them. So that's why I thought you might have a situation where, you know, that top guy made a mistake from a UX perspective and everybody copied him and nobody bothered to think about it.
Okay, two more things I don't like about themes, very common ones. One is overuse of colorful dashboards, which mm-hmm. nobody needs. And instead of, you know, jumping into the main content table and doing work, you see like a bunch of bells and whistles again, right, just because they were in the admin template. And the second thing, I mean, I love Google Material Design and their guidelines, like the whole trend and how it looks. But I think it's super hard to grasp from the user side. And there is a bunch of themes that look so pretty, but they use these guidelines, and as a result, they're kind of not very easy to grasp.
I think all those themes, like, that's the thing, is they're so, they have to build them with such a focus on the marketing of them. And then that doesn't really make for the optimal theme for any particular project. So it's like, we have to have 8 million pieces of navigation because we want to make sure anybody who sees this theme says, oh yeah, I need a user's, you know, right, a section, and I need a dashboard, whatever. I need these different sections. So we're going to have every section possible. And then, yeah, everyone's a dashboard focus because it looks pretty in the one screenshot you get. But like, when you go to build your app, nobody really uses dashboards. So.
Exactly. The demo includes all kinds of elements. But when you go and build your app with one data table inside, it suddenly becomes boring. Then you have this lonely data table and then 20 menus hanging around it because, you know, the author of the theme decided to include 20 menus. Like, they like to include like 5 kinds of notification menus in every corner. Kind of need to make a decision, strip some of them off, you know.
But and that's why I feel like a lot of these like apps that have come up fast lately is like, even if it's like a Calendly or is using some other app recently, but I almost feel like this is what I usually do. I don't know. We'll get your opinion since you're the professional here. But what I have been doing a lot lately is just using like Twitter Bootstrap. And so it's just like, it's got the shell stuff you need of different components, but you just put that together. It looks reasonable, even if you do nothing at all. And then you can also style it fairly easily. So just start with like a pure Bootstrap theme, and it gives you the components, and it's not really any, it's really less complicated than a ThemeForest theme because you don't have to like take out a million things you don't need. You just add in the stuff you do. And then, you know, you can always have that professionally designed later, or, you know, just cobble it together and it looks kind of reasonable, even if you don't do much to it, at least it doesn't look totally horrible. I don't know, that seems to work better for me. And then you don't have this big mess of stuff there, but I don't know.
That's a valid approach too, totally valid. Well, you know, even being a designer, I do understand that if a thing works and it makes sense and looks kind of reasonable and not ugly, then it's totally fine as soon as it solves some kind of real pain for the user. If they need to make it done, I mean, to get it done, they will absolutely be happy to use any kind of UI you have. So, yes, as
teachable founder...
Yeah, Teachable founder Ankur Nagpal, in his interview, he said that the SaaS goes through 2 stages. First is being not ugly, and second is actually prettifying stuff. And for the first one, anything will do, like theme or your method, as soon as it works. And you know, software built by developers is actually most times quite good and logical. There were situations when the non-technical founder tries to put something together, because most times these people have not been using like 50 types of SaaS services, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's what a lot of themes are focused on too. It's like, oh, this is kind of what I want, you know? And I mean, I've used them before too, but it's like, it does seem like there's that focus there. And then people kind of are stuck with this thing with 40 jQuery plugins and stuff sliding over the screen everywhere and everything.
Yeah, so just make a thing simple, make sure it works, and you're going to be all right. It doesn't have to be super beautiful, for sure. And you know, Calendly founder, I just want to share his story because I find it awesome. So his name is Tope Owotona, and before he's a non-technical founder, so he didn't have much of like financial runway for development. So he really had to nail the UX from day one, kind of. And he did extended customer research and discovery. And during his discovery phase, he reviewed over 30 scheduling apps, became a user of each of them and like identified their good things and bad things about them and reconciled it all together in one good Calendly UI. And, you know, I could give him a gold medal for that.
Yeah, that's definitely the right way to do it. And I love that. I mean, we moved to Calendly recently and it is much nicer and simpler. So it's great.
Yeah, I just admire this approach a lot because, you know, as a non-technical founder, that resonates so much with me.
There's this gap. I remember an interview, Ian, you had with Jack McDade from Statamic.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is my pronunciation Statamic right?
Yep.
Yeah. So he's a designer.
I'm never really sure, but I think that's right.
He's a designer and a developer. So it's sort of like all clicks. Because like when you have developers like me who are not designers, I sort of have to either hire somebody or wait until my wife has enough time to sort of do a design because she's a designer for us, or my stuff just looks like butt for a long time, when you have a non-technical designer or a business person, then you could sort of see these WordPress-driven plugin fests that are like, you could see the seams between all of these plugins. Oh, so they sort of work together, kind of.
I love the way you put that, plugin fest.
And it's so rare to have like somebody who's like a good designer and a good developer. Like, so you take a look at some of Jack's stuff and it's like, yeah, that this is where it clicks, you know?
Yeah, his stuff's really seamless. That's a good word too, yeah. Like, yeah, they're like, even their like help docs and everything are insane. Like, these are the most beautiful help docs ever for this.
Yeah, I mean, usually you have a team, right? Like somebody at Stripe, you have like a whole army of designers and an army of developers, and you throw enough people at the wall and, you know, stuff works. Sure. But, you know, when you have one person who's that focused, it's sort of like, it's a rare thing.
There is Josh Pickford of Barometrics who comes to mind. I mean, he has a team now, but he made Barometrics with his hands, being both a designer and a developer too. I call these people dangerous, and they really are.
Yeah, I can see it being, it's like a positive, but it's also a negative because it's even more stuff to obsess over. You're like, because you know you're capable of making it beautiful. Whereas like, if you're just the developer, you're like, I know it's not going to be beautiful. Let me just move on to the next thing. Like, keep moving forward progress. But but yeah, no, that is, if you can pull that off, it's amazing.
You know, I feel such a pain because I do have a technical training. I have education as a programmer in a legal field, but it's Russian, and in Russia we have such a huge like distance between real life and education. So it just makes me able to think logically, but doesn't make me like one of those dangerous people at all. Unfortunately, I wish.
Well, maybe someday you start chipping away. See, you're keeping yourself too busy by producing new stuff. You got to give yourself a little time now to pick up something new.
Exactly. I had these idea a couple years ago whether I should start learning to code hands-on, and I've seen people who do that, but I decided, well, I do something really good, I just should keep doing that.
That's not a bad idea either.
I don't know which is the best. Should I be like 50 years old and now deciding to learn code?
You gotta check out a friend of the show here, Jeffrey Way, who runs Laracasts, which is a really great kind of training tool for learning the program. So you should check that out. It's cheap and you chip away at it. I think it's always good when anybody doing design or UX, like, you know, knows how it's built. Even if you don't aren't building complicated web applications, you know, it's always nice to have that insight. I think sometimes it makes those conversations easier.
Absolutely. So true.
Push back when developers tell you it's not possible, because you know what is and isn't possible very well.
Do you know there is one more tool that makes people even more dangerous? Is copywriting. And I kind of explored a lot of that over the last few years, and I do highly recommend it to anyone. I think the person who masters all three would probably like kill the business.
That's one of those pick two out of three things. Like, you can't be a master at all three. It's impossible. Like, you could be a master at two of those, but not all three. But yeah, no, good copywriting is definitely huge. Not a treat I'm that good at, but yeah, if you're able to make those tight headlines, like, that's huge these days. Nobody has any time.
You would think that after like 11 years of running our companies that we would be like pretty decent at like all three or all around, but it didn't evolve that way. It sort of just got sort of better at the stuff you already were strong at.
Well, so the past like 3 months, I feel like I've almost like been starting a new business or something, because we're just I'm spending so much time on different things I did way back at the beginning and then haven't done it all since. So whether it's the content marketing stuff or even just like, this is partially development. I talked about it on the show a little bit, but custom building the website to like have some more capabilities in terms of like personalizing things for visitors and a whole bunch of other stuff it does. So like I don't know, basically thinking about marketing more strategically than I've done in the past, but it's like, wow, that's like a lot of stuff I should know how to do or be better at, which I'm not. So it's a lot of catch up there. But you know,
before jumping on this podcast, I reviewed Andrew's current site and
my site. Yes, that I haven't touched since 2002.
And now I see that call to action, which says, if you like what you see, come work with us or something like that. And I'm like, oh man, this man is so happy by getting leads with this call to action. Really amazing. And actually, site looks pretty good.
See that? You don't need to update it. Go another 10 years.
It's always in the constant stage of, oh, we're rebuilding a new version of it. So there's like three different versions at the same time.
Well, I think when you're like solo or very small, the other problem is, and when you're a programmer, you just have all these ideas, whether it's the thing you're working on and ways to make it better or just other things you'd like to build. And so you just make yourself so busy. You're always so busy doing stuff that you don't learn how to do anything new. Like you might get better at some aspect of coding or something like that. That's tangential to the thing you want to build, but you don't tend to take as much time for just reading Copy Hackers or reading UI audit book or, thinking strategically about what you're doing marketing wise or what you're doing in these other ways. And obviously now in the last couple of years, there's been a lot more focus on that for founders and growth hacking and all this stuff. And so people have paid, I think, more attention to it, even in bootstrap circles down here with us small folk. But for most of the time since 2004, when I started HelpSpot, I mean, I think that was not really something that people gave a lot of thought to in the way that now it's becoming more of a thing to do and obviously a smart thing to do. But I know it's like a new generation.
As you mentioned, this oversaturation of email marketing, like techniques that you can see everywhere, all the same.
Right.
I'm kind of observing the same in the software industry, and I'm sure you did too, because before that you had like one tool for each kind of work, and now for each kind of assignment, like you have 20 possible software products to automate the hell out of stuff, and you get like, I saw your tweet about cutting like $100 subscriptions to gain more $100 subscriptions, right? Was it worse? Yes.
I canceled $100 subscription and then the next day I ended up buying a service, different service that's $100 subscription.
Exactly. And I feel something's going on. I mean, something's going to happen like a dot-com boom or something because it can't be so many services going on in this industry.
Yeah, well, Ian already thinks that everything's going to be zero.
I do.
Everything's just going to cost nothing.
This is the death throes. But I do think it is tricky as like some of these software companies get bigger and then they have more money to like throw at all the different niches. Like it makes it hard for bootstrapped, you know, founders to hide in one of those niches. Like for a long time, HelpSpot just hid in its niches. So now we have to like, that's, you know, a large part of what we've been doing is that like we can't really hide in our niches anymore because everybody's out there, other than maybe being downloadable, which is a niche that nobody seems to want these days. So HelpSpot still has that niche. But other than that, like head to head, it's a lot harder for people who want a hosted help desk to, you know, there's a million of them, which has always been a lot, but now there's even more and they're better at crawling into kind of the niches that maybe we had before. So it's tricky as you have all this like VC backed money out there. So they're just able to very quickly throw a lot of people in marketing at different areas. So we'll see.
Yeah.
But that is tricky. It's going to shake out a little bit. But then again, it's all about being in a good area too. Like if you're in an area that are like, you know, with the help desk software, every company needs this essentially. So, you know, you can find new niches and come at it in different ways. And there's still a market. You're not going to get totally kicked out of a market, hopefully. Whereas, you know, there's definitely other areas where it's like, well, it's not as big a market. And, you know, there could be a huge gorilla that comes in and just totally destroys you. And that's it. But
I think there's like Jane is in one of those that I think there's a lot of room, not a lot, but more than just pure software. In terms of carving out a niche and building a nice business for yourself, like UX with a consulting offer there, or something like system administration. If you build like that type of business that Jane is building around UX, but as a system administrator, I think there's a nice position there to be had as well. So outside of pure software, I think you could build a nice consultancy if you focus tightly.
Oh, yeah. Because all these businesses and organizations that want to do, you know, they want to modernize in different ways and they don't know how to do it and they don't have the people in-house to do it. So I definitely think consulting is, you know, everybody always complains about being a consultant, but I feel like it's a great place to be right now that, you know, you can't hire, it's hard for a lot of organizations to hire the great people to do these things, or sometimes it just doesn't make sense because you don't need a full-time person to do whatever it is, you know, for the next 10 years. You just need somebody to help you with it for a certain time period. So, yeah, I think that's totally a great way to go. I would totally do that. If we didn't have the software business, I think I'd be a consultant. Because I don't know, like if I was starting from scratch, I think that would be the way I'd go. Because I don't know, I feel like you could own an area more easily too. Like you could own your physical region if you want to get out and do stuff like that, or even just strictly online. You can kind of create these niches and spread the word. I mean, it's all hard work either way, but I do think there's a lot of opportunity there still.
Hey, Jane, I have a question. Does Russia locally have that this sort of startup-y, bootstrappy thing that America has?
It kind of does, but I find that the budgets and the whole game is so much lower. So it's that employers don't have the culture of paying a lot of money to developers and designers, and the audience doesn't have a good habit of paying, like, you know, the $30-$50 range. It's an incredibly lot of money for Russia. People have trouble, you know, paying $5 for a monthly subscription for something and say like, oh, that's a ton of money. So I think it's like a few years behind, a number of years behind, and it's really scarce in budget. I think that's the main restriction. But a lot of smart minds, like absolutely, and a lot of smart minds are currently outsourced to, like, we have in our city, we have a good university and we have like a programming plant where all these engineers are sitting down working for an American company. And they would offer you $2,000 per month, and it would be a super competitive salary, while in the US, can you imagine that? 24 grand per year, come on. Like, and these are the smartest people, seriously.
Right. Yeah, that's wild. Yeah.
That's why I'm here. It's good to know English.
That's interesting.
Yeah, but doing what you do, you know, I guess, yeah, you have to know English, but like everything is remote what we do, and you have such a good position that you're able to, you know, offer these world-class like US consulting services from where you are. It's probably a much better position than like what, you know, some of those people that have to work at the programming factory do.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, it's a different world. You know, we got to do all this stuff that's remote now. It opens up so many opportunities.
I'm eternally grateful to have all these things like internet, PayPal, you know, all these things that make it possible. It's amazing. We didn't have that 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Did you learn English in school or after?
Oh, okay. I've been learning English throughout school. Then I won a scholarship and went to South Carolina as an exchange student.
Ah.
Spent a year there, polished my Southern accent. Then I came back a few more times as an exchange student during the university. So it's been a few trips. And I also worked as an interpreter, as a translator. I used to teach Russian students English language. Mm-hmm. As a student. So I have a long story with English. It's great that it now has like a big application.
Yeah, no, I think it's obviously a huge, you know, great foresight you had to pursue that, I think. And since it is on the, you know, on the kind of internet, no Americans speak anything but English, obviously. So if you want to sell stuff here, you kind of need that. So yeah, that's great.
So how would somebody go about, you're taking on clients right now?
Absolutely. I would love new consulting clients.
So what's the process like if one of our listeners wants to?
So I have an entry point consulting product, which is called the UI audit. And people have been raving about these because it gives like for a certain amount of dollars, it gives you a solid outlook on what exactly you should be focusing on, where exactly your usability flaws lie, and what exactly causes such a huge volume of support or something like that. By the way, you mentioned those signs when people need to fix their UI and high support levels. I forgot about that, but that's key.
Yeah.
It's like, where do I find this? And in this case, you need to go find myself and we need to do an audit. So it's an entryway thing. Then we do like, we can extend the relationship into wireframing session or develop like visual style for the app. The possibilities are endless. So just get in touch at uibreakfast.com. There is plenty of stuff there.
Awesome. Thank you. Ian, you have any more questions?
No, this has been great. Thanks for coming on, Jane.
Thanks for coming on, Jane.
We will see you in a couple of weeks at Bacon Biz. So that's
Bacon
great.
Bacon Biz.
Thank you. Absolutely.
Yeah. So where can people find out more about the UI audit book?
A great question. So you can get the book or you can download free chapter with worksheets on product strategy at uibreakfast.com/audit. And I've put together a special promo code for you guys. It's bootstrapped20 for $20 off any package of the book.
Awesome. So we'll put that in the show notes also. So check that out. And thanks a lot, Jane, for coming on. And we'll see you soon.
Thanks very much.
It was a great conversation. Thank you so much.
All right. Have a good one.